Special Sauce is brought to you by Soyve. Unlock the awesome with marinades like Very Very Teriyaki and Hoisin Garlic.
Welcome to Call Special Sauce. I'm Ed Levine. This week, another chance for you, our loyal podcast listeners, to ask questions of me and our brilliant Serious Eats Food Lab columnist, managing culinary director, and best-selling author Kenji Lopez-Alt. We had such a blast doing the first two call-ins, we had to do it again. And so we are. Our motto is, what Kenji cannot answer is probably unknowable, though I will not resist throwing in my two spoonfuls as well. We're on different coasts, so first, hey, Kenji, man, you look so tan.
Thanks. Did I send you a picture of myself?
No,
you're following my Instagram feed.
No, I'm just following your Instagram feed.
Well, I've been tracking my tan level, I guess.
Many of you have already emailed questions to specialsauce@serioseats.com. We welcome them anytime you happen to be listening. Kenji, it's time for our first caller, Christy.
Hi.
Hey, Christy, where are you calling from?
Denver, Colorado.
I believe that when I did a hot dog investigation a few years ago, we found that there was a guy in Denver making hot dogs out of things like bison and venison.
Biker Jim?
Yeah, Biker Jim. Do you like Biker Jims?
I do, because I like eating, you know, hot dogs that are a little bit different. Otherwise, you go to Mustard's Last Stand, and they're pretty good.
Got it.
But they're more drunk food than anything else.
Well, there's a lot of drunk food in the world that we consume, isn't it? Isn't there?
Hey, Christy, have you had a chance to try those new Beyond Meat meatless burgers yet? I think they're only available in the Denver and Boulder area right now.
I haven't yet, but I just started a job in Boulder, so that's one of my goals.
Oh, you did? Oh, cool. Well, you have to let us know how they are, because I've been dying to get my hands on some.
Yeah.
You can always fly out here. We can do it together, you know.
All right. Let's the three of us. We're going to get on planes.
And my sister. My sister's in Boulder.
Yeah. And Kenji's sister's in Boulder. She's really cool. All right. So as Christy has a really, really interesting problem, so can you please elaborate on it?
Yeah. So I found out the very hard way that I am actually very, very allergic to mushrooms. To the point where even if they're in a dish and you remove them from the dish, I will still get a reaction. Mm. And it's a few exposures away from an EpiPen sort of allergic reaction.
That's really not good.
Not really, no, especially when you're trying to eat a lot of different foods like I do. So my real question is, how do you get that kind of umami flavor, that impact, that savoriness in dishes when you can't have something like that? What do you substitute mm-hmm. instead?
And you're talking about cooking at home as opposed to eating
cooking
out at restaurants?
Cooking at home or even asking at a restaurant, you know, if it's in the dish but it lends a specific flavor, is there a way you can ask them to do it too? But more specifically, mm-hmm. it's like at home, if I want to get that really powerful flavor, how do I do it without, you know, risking my life and all that?
Right. Important. I mean, Ed, this is something you and I have, I think, talked about a lot in the past. And
yes,
do you want to try?
I can give you
take a stab at this one?
The passionate eater's response, and then Kenji can actually help you solve your problem. One of the things I've learned from eating Kenji's awesome turkey burgers is that Marmite, which is a food product usually found in England, but you can get it here in specialty shops and online, obviously. So that Marmite is one of those things you can add, Christy, to get to an umami bomb. You know, fish sauce is another thing that mm-hmm. Kenji has taught me about. And not all fish sauces are created equal, and Kenji can probably elaborate on that. And the third one that I know of is really good soy sauce.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And then I have to turn it over to my man here.
Well, so all those things you've talked about, Marmite, Vegemite, which is the Australian version, fish sauce, soy sauce, those are all ingredients that are really rich in glutamic acid, which is an amino acid, and it's the chemical that triggers our sense of umami. So in the same way that sodium chloride, table salt, triggers our sense of saltiness, and sucrose and other sugars will trigger our sense of sweetness. Glutamic acid and a few other chemicals as well, but mainly glutamic acid will trigger our sense of savoriness.
Umami is, right, Kenji?
And that is what umami is, exactly, yes.
Okay.
So when you're talking about, replacing mushrooms in dishes, it's a little bit more complicated than that, though, because I think the real question is what kind of dishes are you making? So, if you're making like a mushroom stuffed ravioli or like a mushroom risotto, something like that, obviously you're not going to be able to replace those mushrooms because they add more than just that savory element, that umami flavor. They also add their own flavor and their own texture and that earthiness. But if you're talking about mushrooms as a flavoring in other dishes, so for example, if you're making like a like grinding mushrooms and adding them to a pasta sauce, or if you're making a mushroom duxelle, or if you're stir frying them and using them to add flavor to a broth or a sauce, those are the places where I think you could be able to replace them with an appropriate glutamic acid rich ingredient. What kind of stuff do you like to cook at home?
I really love Asian food, which is where this kind of comes in, because to your point, it's not just adding the flavor, it's the texture, it's all those other components. Mm-hmm. Specifically,
so you're talking like a stir fry or something like that?
Like a stir fry, because I can't have stir fries out at a restaurant because I'll still get exposed to, the residual mushrooms.
So I end up making it at home, or things
like miso soup, which are really delicate. But I don't want to have just the wakame flavor. I'd rather have something a little more robust in it too sometimes.
Got it. Well, so with a stir fry, I think we need to tackle the question from two different angles. We need that textural element that mushrooms add, and I assume you're talking something like sliced mushrooms, like sliced shiitakes or something like that. And then there's also the flavor that they lend to the rest of the dish. As far as texture goes, I think the closest bet you have is a really firm, dense tofu, maybe like a Thai style tofu, the kind that comes. Sometimes you'll see them. They'll be vacuum sealed, and sometimes they'll have like a kind of yellow or pink coloring on the outside. They're denser than even if you buy something labeled firm or extra firm. This is a special type of tofu that's even denser than that, and it has a really sort of very mushroom like texture to it. And you can slice that into slivers and add them to stir fries. And then if you couple that with something like Marmite or fish sauce or soy sauce, that I think can really go a long way to boosting that umami flavor and giving you some of that mushroomy texture.
My next question is, as far as using like the tofu and then coupled with something like a Marmite or a fish sauce, mm-hmm. would you marinate the tofu in it or would you use it separately? How would you suggest incorporating it?
Yeah, you could.
Together?
I mean, you can do it separately, especially in something like a stir fry where it's all going to get coated in a sauce at the end anyway. I think it's fine to do it separately. If you wanted to do something like, like grilling a piece of tofu or something to get, like let's say you wanted to make a mushroom-free like portobello burger, so a portobello burger is already what people do instead of beef burgers. And if you wanted to take it another level and do tofu instead of portobello in there, but give it a mushroomy flavor,
put it on top.
In that case, you could definitely marinate it. I would suggest using an ingredient like miso, like making a whisking together some miso paste and maybe some olive oil or peanut oil, along with maybe some herbs and garlic or a little bit of soy sauce, maybe a little bit of wine or sake, and marinating your tofu in that, and then grilling it. And that miso is going to give it like a really nice color. It's also going to give it a really deep umami flavor. Earlier you were asking about broth for things like miso soup.
Miso, yeah.
Traditional miso soup doesn't actually have mushrooms in it. The broth is made with smoked dried bonito, katsuobushi, and kombu, which is seaweed, sea kelp. And interestingly, kombu is where MSG, monosodium glutamate, was first synthesized, extracted and purified from. So, in Japan, the company that makes MSG, powdered MSG, is called Ajinomoto. And that's been around, I think, off the top of my head, I believe it was since the early 20th century. They used to grow and harvest sea kelp and make their MSG powder out of that.
Now, Christy, have you ever made or had one of Kenji's turkey burgers?
I have not.
Okay.
Do you recommend them?
Oh, my God.
Even over Biker Jim's hot dogs?
You know, that's a really tough call, but I think Kenji titled that post "Turkey Burgers That Don't Suck," and they really, because of the Marmite, they really are the first turkey burgers I've ever loved.
Now I have to ask then: do you think it's okay to use Vegemite in lieu of Marmite? Because I have a hard time finding Marmite here, but I can get Vegemite, and I do love Vegemite.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, they're essentially the same process. You know, both of them are yeast extracts, and you know, the only difference is that they come from different parts of the world. Is there a big Australian expat population in Denver?
No, just oddly enough, my local grocery store seems to carry Vegemite in enormous jars for some reason, which will last you a good couple of lifetimes.
That's awesome. So I hope we've answered your question, Christy.
Definitely. You've been a great help. Thank you so much. I'm going to try some of that tonight, I think.
All right. Awesome. And don't forget to try that turkey burger recipe and get back to me.
Definitely. Thank you guys so much.
Thank you for calling.
Thank you.
Bye.
It's time for our next caller, Kenji. Aditya, welcome to Call Special Sauce. Am I pronouncing your name correctly?
Yeah, that's actually really good.
I speak 17 languages. Ask Kenji.
I think that's actually the first time you got a caller's name right off the bat.
Don't tell him that. All right. Aditya, where are you calling from?
I'm calling from Toronto up in Canada.
Toronto. I've been to Toronto twice in the last 2 years, and there's a lot of really interesting ethnic food going on in Toronto.
Oh, yeah, there really is. The food scene here is quite interesting.
But you're going in the other direction because you want to know about cooking at home. So tell us about your specific problem.
Sure. So cooking, I think, right now is probably my number one hobby. It's not my main thing. I don't plan on making it my job or anything like that. But something I've kind of struggled with over the years is how to do things at home, be better cook at home without being required to put in sort of many, many hours to really, really learn how things are. So, for example, like, I don't even really understand what al dente pasta should be. In a sense, I'm asking, how can I become a better craftsman without having to perfect the craft?
You might be asking the wrong person when you're talking to Kenji, because he's obsessive in his pursuit of craft. But to me,
it sounds like you're asking. It sounds to me like you're saying, I would like to go play a piano concerto in Carnegie Hall, but I don't want to practice the piano or listen to other piano players.
But it's not quite that. I do understand.
No, it's not.
But there is an aspect to it that is like that. But the question I have is, what you're asking really is, how do you know what things are supposed to taste like?
And yeah. How do you know what good is?
Yes, how do you know what good is? And I always talk about, and this is a friend of mine that I've introduced Kenji to, Nancy Silverton in L.A., who's a bread baker, pastry chef, and chef restaurateur, who I always describe as having perfect food pitch. In other words, she always knows what good is and why it's good.
But that's an amazing term.
Yeah, and so I think what you're in pursuit of is, if not perfect food pitch, good food pitch. And mm-hmm. and Kenji can address this from both a cook's point of view and an eater's point of view. I can give you, from an eater's point of view, what I've learned is that if I'm tasting something for the first time and I want to know what it's supposed to taste like, it helps if I'm with someone who knows a lot about that cuisine and whose taste buds I trust.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, I mean, and by the way, that's happened a lot with me and Kenji, because Kenji knows much more about things like Chinese food, specifically Sichuan food. When I'm tasting Mapo Tofu, I feel like I've learned so much about what it's supposed to taste like and what is a good version from Kenji. And then I'll let Kenji take it over from there. But
well, yeah, I mean, to me, this question actually reminds me a lot of, Ed, you were a musician at one point.
Yes.
I grew up playing a lot of music. And, you know, when I went to music school in high school and college, there were two different kinds of classes. So there was the technical classes and lessons where you would learn how to, you know, violin was my instrument. So I would learn how to play violin and I would learn the technical skills to get good at violin. But then we also had ear training and theory classes. And those are the ones that taught you what you were supposed to sound like and what made music good and what good tone was and what good pitch was and how to play and what being in tune meant and all those things. And so it sounds like what you need is a little bit of both of those classes in terms of cooking. You need food ear training or tongue training, maybe is what it is. And then you also need to take you also need to do some of that technical training. But, you know, it's really hard to do that technical training, like you said, until you have done the tongue training part. There's a couple ways to go about this. I think the first and probably most important thing to realize is that, you know, the widely accepted definition of what good, quote unquote, good is, doesn't have to be your personal definition of what good is.
Oh,
you know,
of course.
You shouldn't let other people tell you what tastes good to you. The first thing to do is realize that and just try and aim to make food, you know, think to yourself, how do I want this to taste? And then aim to make it taste that way. But, you know, of course, when you're having conversations about food, you know, there are these sort of like cultural norms and expectations for how specific things are supposed to taste. And so when you invite friends over, there is an expectation of things tasting a certain way. So, and that's where you really do need to sort of, I think, pay attention to what people expect of good food. My advice would be to maybe find a group of friends and just start, you know, a dining club, whether it's cooking for each other at home and reading things or going out to restaurants. But, you know, a group of friends that'll inspire you to really think about what you're eating as you're eating it and force you to have these kinds of conversations and think about your food. Because a lot of people, when they go out to eat, they don't really think critically about it. And that's fine. You know, sometimes it's fine to go out and just enjoy yourself and say this is good without really thinking about what
yeah,
makes
absolutely.
It good. But I find it useful to take, you know, to bring either a notebook or these days on my phone and take photos and take little notes on my phone of what I'm eating just so that I can sort of remember and catalog in my brain what was enjoyable about this and how it differs from other versions of it. So, you know, if you go to eat pasta in five different Italian restaurants, you can order the same dish and it's going to taste different in each one. They're probably all, you know, because they're Italian restaurants, they're all probably striving for the same end result. You know, they want their pasta al dente. They want it to be sauced properly.
Right.
But they go about it in different ways.
And this is really the result, I think, Aditya, of the fact that we are living in a cross-cultural environment. So you're coming from a place where you grew up eating Indian food.
Yeah.
And so this probably isn't a problem for you when it comes to Indian food, whereas I could really use your help. Like if I go to an Indian restaurant in Toronto, I want to bring you. You know,
and what I'll tell you is that there's not a whole lot here that I can go for.
Yeah, I was going to ask, would you say that people who didn't grow up eating Indian food, what do they think of the Indian food scene in Toronto?
People generally tend to like it. And, you know, I sort of come in and I say, you know, like it's not bad food. It's just not what I'm looking for when it comes to Indian food.
This is one of those tragedies, one of those paradoxes in life that the more you know about something, the fewer places you find to enjoy it because you start noticing all the things that are wrong with it.
Yeah.
And what do you think of your own Indian cooking?
I like to think it's pretty good. I've had good role models. My parents are both very good cooks. And I'm also really thorough and analytical myself, so I tend to pursue things a little bit like crazy. So, I people tell me it's good. I like it. I like to make it in certain ways, and some of it, I'm sure, echoes the way my parents do things, which may not be how other Indian families do it, but, I think it worked out pretty well when I go for it.
What about the question, Kenji, of if Aditya doesn't have a lot of time to practice especially non-Indian dishes, I don't think there's any substitute for that other than having an eating club and going out. And then hopefully it'll make your home cooking better.
Yeah, there isn't really a substitute for practice. But, you know, I think that's really sort of beyond the scope of the question there, right? The question is not how do I get good at cooking? The question is more how do I figure out what's good food
yeah,
is.
Yeah, like bolognese. Let's take bolognese sauce, right? Kenji makes mm-hmm. – he makes – and do you say bolognese or bolognese? I'm never sure.
Bolognese.
Bolognese. But you give bolognese out for, you told me, to your family in glass jars for holidays.
For Christmas.
Yeah, which is awesome. By the way, Aditya, don't feel bad. He's never sent me any.
You didn't get it last year?
No, I didn't get it last year. It got lost in the mail.
I would check with your doorman.
Yeah, sure. But bolognese is a great, like, how do you know, Kenji, like, how did you get to that bolognese sauce?
Well, that is a good example. You know, the bolognese sauce that I grew up with was ground beef simmered with a can of tomato sauce, which is maybe some onions, which is how my mom made it. And I enjoyed that, you know, and I still enjoy that, too. But that's not really bolognese sauce. It wasn't until actually I started working with Barbara Lynch, a chef in Boston at an Italian restaurant, where I really discovered what bolognese is supposed to be and realized that, oh, bolognese is not a tomato sauce with meat, but bolognese is actually a meat sauce with sometimes a little bit of tomato. And you know, sometimes it does really require the input of an expert to understand what those things are supposed to be. And it's important to realize again that, you know, just because I learned what bolognese is supposed to be, and I really love, you know, traditional bolognese, that doesn't detract from my enjoyment of eating the type of bolognese that my mom made, which is what maybe a lot of other people are familiar with. It just means that I have, I think, a richer experience with it. It also real bolognese is also a richer sauce, I guess.
Yeah.
So we can conclude, Aditya, that A, you got to eat out more. You got to have more friends. You got to invite Kenji to Toronto. And then I think you're good.
Yeah.
Buy a notebook,
all right,
a notebook.
And buy a notebook, exactly. We'll send you a Serious Eats pencil.
Awesome.
Thank you so much, Aditya.
Thank you so much, you guys. I'm really glad to have had the opportunity.
So, Kenji, it's time for our next call on Call Special Sauce.
Great.
And we have Jennifer Rosen. Are you Jenny on the block?
I wish.
And where are you calling from?
From Vancouver.
Another great eating city.
It really is.
Really good Chinese food. And I've been to Vige any number of times, which I love.
Oh, it's fantastic. Yeah.
Yeah. So, like, you're really lucky. You live in such a beautiful place. Although Kenji lives in a pretty beautiful place, and I do love New York. So I guess we're all lucky. So what,
we are.
What can we do for you, Jennifer?
I have got an electric range, and I'm wondering whether there's any good option to try and make one of the beautiful stir fries that Kenji always talks about, whether it's his mapo tofu or mm-hmm. or any of those kind of meals. Like, without a gas range, can I make something like that? Should I try a flat bottom wok? Should I just stick with a heavy skillet? Should I just stick to takeout?
It's a good question. My first bit of advice would be to move to a civilized area that has gas powered ranges.
I'll totally take that under advisement. That's way better than getting a flat bottom wok.
No, you definitely can. You know, even with a gas range, doing a really good stir fry is difficult because home ranges are much more much less powerful than a traditional wok range. Something you'd have in a restaurant or say like a wood or coal fired one like you might find in a Chinese home, like a rural Chinese home.
Yeah, wok ranges get crazy hot, right, Kenji?
Yeah,
I read something about it, and it's one of the things that people talk about when they say, well, how come you don't see more Chinese restaurant chains? There are a few. Is because
right.
It's really, really difficult.
It's a very different skill set and a different set of equipment. Yeah, like a wok range typically will put out about 80,000 to 100,000 BTU, British thermal units. It's a unit of energy. It's a unit of power, sorry. Whereas home ranges are somewhere around like the 10 to 11,000 even.
Wow.
The most powerful ones, maybe 15,000.
So they're like 7 times more powerful.
Yes, much, much more powerful. And you know, the reason why that's important, so there's a couple of reasons. First of all, it allows you to add ingredients successively and add a large number of ingredients successively without losing too much heat in the pan. So if you try stir-frying on a Western range and you do it exactly the way they do it in a restaurant, you'll start by adding some oil. You'll add maybe some dry aromatic ingredients, some dried chilies, things like that to flavor the oil. Then you'll add maybe your proteins, like your sliced beef, sliced chicken, something like that. You'll stir fry it. Then on top of that, you'll add vegetables. Then you'll add more aromatics and more, and then you'll add a sauce. And so there's all these things you're putting in succession into a wok. And each time you add those things, you're robbing the wok of energy. And with a good high-powered wok range, there's enough power coming into that wok and enough energy going into that wok that you don't really lose a lot of heat, and you're able to continuously sear food, continuously brown it, and drive off excess moisture. When you try that on a home range, what ends up happening is that the liquid from the food comes out, it doesn't get boiled off fast enough, and so instead of searing, you end up boiling and simmering and steaming all of your food, and so your stir fries end up tasting very, very different. A high output wok range at a restaurant, it also reacts a little bit differently, because when you're actually tossing the food up over that back lip of the wok, some of the heat from the burner is going to cause the vaporized oil in there to ignite, and if you've ever watched like a YouTube video or just walked into the back of a Chinese restaurant and looked at the people cooking, you'll see that there's these flames that come up above the wok as they stir fry.
I've always wondered why.
And it's like 1,000 degrees back there.
And that's all vaporized oil that's coming off of the food and igniting above it. And when that happens, you end up getting that flavor, what they call wok hei. It's the smoky flavor that you get from a really good stir fry. And you don't really get any of that at home. So the way I deal with it with a gas burner is to cook in batches. I'll separate all of my different ingredients, keep the vegetables separate from the meat. I'll probably cook the meat in two different batches as well. So between each batch, I really let that wok heat up and retain a lot of heat. That way I can add, say, you know, 1/2 pound of vegetables at a time maybe is enough, that is a small enough amount that you can really actually sear and stir fry properly without letting them steam. And then as each successive batch of ingredients is cooked, I drop it into a bowl on the side. And then at the very end, I'll toss it all back together with the sauce just to get that sauce to coat them. So that's a method that works pretty well with a gas grill and a gas stovetop. And with a gas stovetop, you can also get some of that oil vaporization. A electric stovetop is a bigger problem, though, because a gas stovetop, you have actual flames that come out. They heat the bottom of the wok, but they also heat the sides of the wok a little bit. And you have those flames that lick up the back as you're flipping the food to get you that vaporized oil flavor. An electric stovetop only heats through direct contact. So you're only going to be heating the bottom of a wok. If you have a round bottom wok, there's nothing you can do on an electric stovetop.
So would Jennifer's idea of a flat bottom wok be helpful?
Yeah, so a flat bottom wok is a good first step. With an electric stovetop, you can also use a skillet because a skillet is going to get much better contact with that electric element. Jennifer, do you have access to outdoor space there?
Yes,
like a deck or a backyard or something.
Yeah, I've got a balcony with a barbecue, like a gas grill out on it.
A gas grill. Okay. Do you have access to a place where you can build an actual fire? Like limited in what you can do. A flat bottom wok or a heavy skillet will help you get some of that searing action. It won't deliver that sort of vaporized oil smoky flavor. If you did have access to an outdoor space where you can build a fire, cooking over a pile of coals or even over a campfire in a wok is a really great way.
What about using the charcoal chimney? Would that be an option?
Yes.
Or is that just...
Yeah, absolutely. So you can take a charcoal chimney, flip it upside down, actually. If you take a charcoal chimney and keep it in its normal position and put some charcoals inside it and light them up, you can stick a wok on top of there, but the wok actually covers up that whole opening, the round opening on the top, which disrupts the airflow, and so your charcoal ends up losing a lot of heat. So you don't get the heat that you need to cook with it. But if you flip that whole chimney upside down, down, charcoal chimneys have vent holes cut into the bottom. And so when you flip it upside down, those vent holes end up at the top. So you put the charcoal in the opposite chamber of where it's supposed to go, light it up and have the whole thing upside down, and then you can put a wok on top of it, and it'll actually get really nice and hot.
That's genius. That's genius, Kenji. Jennifer, don't you think that's genius?
We all know he's a genius. Come on.
Wait, and Jennifer, you're Jennifer from Serious Seats. You're Sheer Genius from Serious Seats and Twitter.
Yes,
is that
I am.
Right? Okay.
We love your handle.
Sheer Genius.
Sheer Genius.
Thank you.
For that alone, you deserve a MacArthur Genius Award. Or should I say Genius Award?
Genius Award.
So, Genius, we should say that for people who don't know, we have frequent commenters on Serious Eats, and I would say that Genius is right up there, right? Wouldn't you say, Kenji, with
pretty,
you know?
Pretty, yeah, definitely recognizable name. Good puns.
He knew you right away when he saw the name.
I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing.
No, it's a great thing.
Now I'm going to have to go back and reread all your comments with a Canadian accent.
Oh, God, no.
Well, I hope
just
we've answered.
Just add A to the end of everything and a really hard R and you'll be fine.
Jennifer, the last little bit of advice that I would give is that if you are going to cook inside with a electric cooktop, get yourself a blowtorch. Either a propane or a butane torch with a head that's going to give you a nice hot flame. And while you're stir frying, and this might take a little practice, but shake and stir the ingredients with your left hand, and then flame them with the blowtorch with your right hand. Don't get too close, but just close enough that you can ignite some of that those oil vapors and get some of that flavor.
We're getting into some insurance problems. I can see it already.
Yeah. Definitely turn off the fire alarms before you start doing this. And take out some extra insurance on your home. But it'll get you the flavor you want. I mean, I think it's worth it, getting that flavor.
And
I'm going to get you to sign off on my insurance papers, I think.
And Kenji,
all in the name of a really good stir fry. I do have one of those little portable butane burners, like that you kind of see like at an omelet station at a buffet.
Oh, okay. I mean, depending on the power of those,
it's usually low.
It's pretty low. Those butane tanks are not usually don't release the gas fast enough to actually get a good flame on them. You know, if you have like a propane powered on your deck you have a gas grill, you said, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that you use a propane tank?
Yeah.
Okay, so you can, you know what you could do is go to and I don't know if they have these in Canada. Do you guys eat turkey in Canada? I'm assuming you do.
Oh, you mean like the deep fried turkey burners?
Yeah, get a deep fried turkey burner. Mm-hmm. And you can buy them at like a Home Depot or whatever your home store is for
Canadian
about 50
Tire
bucks.
Up here. It's Canadian Tire.
Canadian Tire?
Yep.
What is that?
I mean, we have Home Depot, but Canadian Tire is kind of like the Canadian.
Oh, okay, got it. I see.
So that's where you get. That's where you
it's
get.
Like,
your...
It's like the Tim Hortons of home stores.
Yes,
exactly.
Yeah. I hope we've answered your question, and thanks
Absolutely.
So much for
thanks
calling.
Thanks so much for your time, guys.
Good to talk to you.
Take care.
I'm Ed Levine, Serious Eats Overlord, with my running partner, Kenji Lopez-Ault, our Food Lab columnist, our managing culinary director, and now New York Times bestselling author. So we have Kim on the line, do we not?
Hi.
Hi, Kim.
How are you doing, Kim?
Where are you from?
I'm from Hanoi. I'm calling from Hanoi at the moment.
You're calling.
Oh, wow.
This is so awesome that you're calling from Hanoi. Now I know I'm in 2016. You know, we have a caller in real time calling from Hanoi. So what's your question, Kim? I can't even talk about food in Hanoi. Maybe Kenji's been. Have you been to Hanoi?
We were there for a honeymoon, actually. It's a great food city.
So tell Kim what your favorite meal was.
It had to be we had a banh mi from the street that I thought was fantastic, much better than the ones you find than the ones you find in Saigon.
All right, Kim, what's your question?
My question is, what do you think about the concept of authenticity in this globalized world? Like, is authenticity something overrated or that's worth to be preserved? Because I know, like Kenji in the Food Lab, you change a lot of things in a recipe that suits your own taste and you find it, mm-hmm. makes it better. So, mm-hmm. so do you think changes should we welcome the changes that make the dish better, or should we try to preserve the way that a dish is supposed to be made?
That's a great question, Kim.
Yeah. Ed, I mean, I think, Ed, you probably have a lot of thoughts on this because you eat out. I mean, particularly, say, for something like pizza or barbecue.
This is something that I actually think about all the time, Kim. And I used to talk ad nauseum with my old TV co-host, Jeffrey Steingarten, the food critic of Vogue, because he is a big believer in authenticity. And I'm sort of probably where Kenji is. I'm a big believer in deliciousness and what I like. And sometimes that doesn't equal authenticity. So, like, I'm thinking of things like tacos, for example. If tacos in many different parts of Mexico come with little bits of bone in the meat or gristle, does that kind of authenticity make it better? Or would we prefer a taco that was filled with just perfectly seasoned and cooked meat? So this is a question that I find myself asking all the time, and I've never come up with a definitive answer. And Kenji, I think you tend to move sort of in both worlds.
I try to. You know, for me, when I start researching a recipe, and I know that I want to work on a recipe, the first thing I do is always historical research and cultural research, and I really try and figure out what the dish is and what people expect from it. And so, in that sense, it's really just a question of figuring out what authenticity is in terms of that particular dish, and that can be both looking at its history, how it developed, where it came from, and also, you know, going maybe through social media or looking at other blogs and other food websites to people who are at the source and trying to figure out what the actual true version of the dish in its home territory is. But then from there, I think once you understand those things, that's where you sort of become free to then start experimenting and saying, you know what, like, I love Sichuan food, but I don't live in Chengdu, so I'm going to adapt it a little bit to the tools that I have and the ingredients that I have access to, and the taste that I have. And for me, you know, I think as long as you do it in a way that's respectful, and in a way that shows that you understand what it's supposed to be, then you should be free to do it. You know, I think one thing a lot of these sort of authenticity police forget is that there is not really any such thing as authenticity. You know, you think, if you go to your taco, your taco example, Ed, tacos al pastor, you know, we get versions of that in the U.S. They have versions of it in Mexico, and it's, you know, it's pork on a spit with a pineapple on top, marinated pork on a spit with a pineapple on top that you kind of slice the same way that you would slice shawarma. And the reason it's the same way that you slice a shawarma is because it comes from the same place. Tacos al pastor actually come from Lebanese immigrants in Mexico City, and combining their cooking techniques with Mexican flavors. So someone can say authentic tacos al pastor, but you have to realize at some point that dish was created, you know, and at some point someone was saying, wait a minute, what are these new fusion Arab Mexican tacos that we're getting? And then at another point, it eventually just becomes part of the sort of cultural lexicon, and we see that, you know, and then we can start calling them authentic tacos again.
And Kim, do you is this something you're worried about specifically in Hanoi, like when it comes to banh mi or other Vietnamese food? Is this something that you're confronting in your everyday life?
It's not particularly something I worry about. It's just because I was born and raised in Hanoi, and I grew up eating pho with my family. We eat in different places, but I always wonder, is this exactly, like, I hear people arguing over what is this the correct pho, what are they doing wrong, this, what are they doing wrong, that, and I always just wonder, are they criticizing it according to their taste, or is there this way of making pho, this way of dishes that are supposed to be made that I just don't know, because I know to me what pho tastes like, but it's more like my childhood taste.
Yep.
I don't think that's how
Yeah, that makes sense.
I think that's perfectly valid. You know, it's especially interesting because pho is one of those sort of fusion dishes that has, you know, it's broth made from the broth itself comes from Western techniques. All part of the sad imperialist era in Vietnam, but that's where the dish comes from. It wasn't a purely Vietnamese dish. It was influenced by French cuisine as well. So it's interesting to me that there is this idea of authentic pho now. But you know, I think what you grew up with, that's especially as someone who grew up in Vietnam, that's a very good barometer for what I think authentic pho should be. But of course, you can ask a dozen different people in Vietnam who grew up in Vietnam what authentic pho is, and you'll probably get a dozen different answers.
Yeah, it's like Americans with pizza. In my pizza book, Sam Sifton, who's now the food overlord of the New York Times, wrote a piece called "The Pizza Cognition Theory," which held that the first pizza you taste in your life that you grew up with becomes your paradigmatic pizza, you know, becomes what you think of as pizza, and then everything else becomes not pizza. And in a way, that's what I think we're talking about here. It's what you grew up with. And then to Kenji's point, you know,
unless you tasted your first pizza in Chicago, in which case you're just wrong.
Right. Then you're just wrong because then you're tasting a casserole. But I think it is true that what we grew up with, but to Kenji's point, you know, we do at a certain point, just as Kim, you've probably moved past that in the way you taste pho and the way I taste pizza. You know, my original pizza tasting was from Ricky's out on Long Island, right on the Queens Long Island border. But I no longer, or Cairo's, but I no longer think of those as the best pizza I've ever had. They are the first pizzas I've ever had.
It's what's interesting to me is when I write a recipe online for a very traditional dish from another culture, I find that this happens most often with Italian dishes because Italians are very outspoken about the authenticity of their food in general. I find that I'll write something and then somebody will inevitably come along and say, you know, oh, I grew up, this is the way my grandmother made it. Your version is not authentic. But then you'll get someone else saying, oh, well, my grandmother made it this way. And so I think what you have to realize is that, you know, a lot of people's ideas of authenticity is the way that their specific grandmother made it. And so as a food writer or just as someone who likes to eat out and cook and appreciates food in general, I think you have to sort of weigh all those things together to get at what a real concept of authenticity is. And you'll find often that, you know, that idea of authenticity is always shifting, always changing, and it really depends on the context.
And to your point, Kim, I mean, I do think that childhood nostalgia and nostalgia in general definitely plays a role. So if you were an Italian American and your mother served you lasagna, if you're in love with that lasagna, you are not going to care that it's not authentic. And in your mind, that's going to be lasagna, and that's perfectly okay.
To me, an authentic pho, it should, it would not have any kind of herbs or special sauce, anything on it, like the northern way of eating pho. We always make a joke about how that's the thing that divides the country. But
That it, down in Saigon, they squirt all kinds of stuff into it before they eat it.
That's pho pho. Sorry.
But for me, pho would be the broth of pho would have this light savoriness to it, mm-hmm. but also a certain degree of sweetness, and it should be very clear. The broth should be rather light, actually. It should not be heavy, or if you see many grease on top, then that, to me, that's not really how it should be. And even though everyone puts onions on their bowl of pho, I can't stand onions, so I guess I'm not really eating pho really authentically.
Do you like it made with beef or with chicken or?
I like both virgin. To be honest, I don't really mind. I'm someone who, as long as I think it tastes yummy, I will eat it. Mm-hmm. when we go
That's a good basic rule of thumb. Only eat yummy food.
That's very technical.
So, yeah, but my mom makes really good chicken pho. I think that would be my favorite bowl of pho.
See, and, now, and would you call your mom's chicken pho authentic chicken pho?
Definitely not, because sometimes she just decides to, oh, I'm going to add a bit of this, I'm going to add a bit of that, and yeah, I'm just not even going to be bothered boiling chicken for like 5 hours.
Right.
But she made it with love, so I definitely think it's the best bowl of pho.
There we go. That I think may be the perfect endpoint, because food made with love trumps authenticity, I think, or maybe implies authenticity in a way. Anyway, thank you so much, Kim, for giving us an excuse to talk about authenticity.
Thank you so much for choosing my question.
And what's the weather like in Hanoi, man? In New York, Kenji's always has great weather in Northern California. It's really hot and humid. What's it like in Hanoi now?
Oh, my God. It's 40 degrees Celsius in here. You cannot.
Oh, man.
You just cannot go outside.
Ed, I could tell you from our honeymoon, you don't know what hot and humid is until you've been to Vietnam.
Really?
Exactly.
It's like standing. I would take a step outside, and suddenly it was like I took a shower 5 seconds later.
So you have to go out to traffic with a mentality that everyone is out there to kill you if you want to survive.
Wow.
You know what I found in Hanoi was that so crossing the street is the most harrowing experience I've had ever. But what I found was the best way to do it was to actually just close your eyes and walk forward and keep a steady pace. Because if you show any fear or hesitation, people will try and swerve around you, and they won't expect you to stop or anything, and so they'll end up hitting you. If you just walk at a steady pace, all the people on the mopeds, probably with like 4 family members and a bag of frogs on the back, they'll swerve around you because they can tell where you're going to go. It's getting over that initial fear is the trick.
And so the way you got over the initial fear, dude, was to close your eyes.
No, it was to have been recently married and feel like I had to impress my wife.
I see. Thank you so much, Kim, for calling from Hanoi. We really appreciate it.
Thank you so much. I can't imagine how happy I am. Just you two are my idols.
Thank you. Well, that's all the time we have on this episode of Call Special Sauce, but we'll be doing another one soon, so keep those questions coming anytime you hear us or email them to specialsauce@seriouseats.com. Thanks, Kenji, and thanks for listening, Serious Eaters. We'll see you next time.
Bye-bye.